to the Book Riot Podcast. It's a weekly news and talk show about what's new, cool, and worth talking about in the world of books and reading. Today is Thursday, April 13th, 2023. I'm Jeff O'Neill, here with Rebecca Shinsky, coming to you from BookRiot.com. Rebecca, hello.
Hello, you're coming in hot.
I'm trying. Spring is not springing here. I went out and got under the hood of spring here in Portland this morning, and I was like trying to see what's going on.
You tinkering?
They're just kind of moving stuff around. I got out a monkey wrench, a vice, lug wrench. I couldn't pick out a lug wrench.
How's
out of
it
a
going?
Lineup. Can't get it running. Won't turn over. Won't start. I don't know.
Have you checked your bag of like random leftover IKEA parts and various
sizes of Allen
wrenches?
Oh, do you think I need a dongle? Does it need a dongle? Spring needs a
dongle.
A dongle
and an Allen wrench. I think that's what you need.
You try to turn it off and back on again?
Blow on the cartridge, ma'am.
Ames has gotten into trivia recently, and so we got some not even the game of Trivial Pursuit, just like the expansion decks, and just have been asking questions, which has been fun. And there was a 80s deck, which I'll have you know that Michelle and I rolled over our children like thunder down the mountain, which they still want to do the questions, but one of them was about, I can't remember the wording of the question, which is like, kids in the 80s did this routinely to try to get their video games to work. And the answer was blow into the cartridge. And I looked Ames dead in the eye and said, I literally have done that hundreds of times. That's a real thing.
Hundreds. Yeah. It is a
for
real
him,
solution.
For him, it was like getting out in front of a Tin Lizzie and kind of manually starting it with that crank. That was the equivalent sort of cultural reference to him.
I know. I was playing Mario Kart with a friend that I was visiting recently with her kids on Switch. And the Switch hooked up to the big TV. The controllers are really small now. And we waited 10 minutes because Mario Kart was downloading new characters and new courses. And I had to, it was like everything in my power not to be like, in my time, you got five of whatever to start on the game, and that's all you ever had.
That's all you ever had.
And you were happy about it. You had your five courses, and you loved them.
Yeah, we subscribe to like PlayStation subscription service where some games are free every month. Like they kind of turn them over, which is great because you can play a bunch of things. And we haven't played the PlayStation that long. It was a Christmas gift, and I haven't video gamed in a while. And you can just sort of sample it. Like Netflix for games is part of the PlayStation thing. It's pretty awesome. But I told him, I was like, you realize when I was a kid, if I spent $60 on a game, that was my game for 2 to 3 months, if not more, until I got birthday money or Christmas rolled around. Where he plays a game for 45 minutes, not into it, he moves on to the next one. Again, it's better. It's a great price. It's like $15 a month. I don't begrudge him. But the reason I got really good at Super Tecmo Bowl is not because I love Super Tecmo Bowl. It's because that is the game that I had.
I'm pretty confident that I could beat Mario Brothers 3 right now if you put it in front of me for that.
Get that
same
Tanuki
reason.
Suit and go.
Yep.
Well, that's enough intro. Let's do our first sponsor.
Today's episode is brought to you by National Geographic Books. So take a second, think to yourself, what is one of the weirdest but kind of interesting, intriguing, intelligent animals that you know of? If you, like me, think of an octopus, then Secrets of the Octopus by Cy Montgomery is the book for you. It is a beautifully illustrated book that explores the underwater world of the octopus, a creature that resembles an alien life form, but whose behavior has earned it a reputation as one of the most intelligent animals on the planet. This journey into the world of the octopus reveals how large their brains are. They occupy their whole body, not just their heads. They can adjust their genetic makeup to respond to the demands of the environment. So with this book, you can see how the octopus can change shape and color to camouflage themselves more effectively than any other species. They are cool AF. So learn about all of this and more in Secrets of the Octopus. And thanks again to National Geographic Books for sponsoring this episode.
A few reminders. First edition is up. Episode 1 is going. Rebecca and I picking the It Books of April. I was looking at bestsellers of last week, and I think I missed one. Is this a tease? I can maybe tease this.
Yeah.
Jeanette Walls has a new novel out in April, and it sold. It like premiered at number, debuted at like number 5 on the NPD BookScan hardcover fiction list. I like Jeanette Walls. I apparently have no read on how popular she is, because it moved like 12,000 copies, which is big for, that's mid-list, what's even the hook? So I don't know if I would have put that back. So Rebecca and I did a power, or a knockout round, had 10 books. Jeanette Wall's new book, which I can't remember the flipping title of. That's how on the radar it was for me. I'll probably read it eventually. I like Jeanette Wall's. I love The Glass Castle. I missed that one. But that's going to happen. But we're trying to pick the It book. It's hard. We're just two people. We're just two podcasters standing in front of publishing, asking it for data. And sometimes we get it wrong. But it was a lot of fun. On the other hand, I think I got it mostly right. But in terms of the top 10, I think I would have had to put Jeanette Wall's on there. And I'm going to learn this. I'm going to have to pick my spot with debut authors. Maybe I can put one on there if there's a lot of heat. But like we're talking about The House of Cotton, my Monica Brashears, I put it on that list. You and I both really liked it. It just doesn't really have a chance unless it gets picked by Barnes & Noble or whatever. Right. It's just not going to have a chance. We know this. So yeah. I think I'm going to augment a little bit to have, here's the 10 and then a couple of honorable mentions of books I just want to shout out that are interesting, long shots, dark horses, but don't really have a real shot. I'm looking at May. May is very top heavy.
It is. May, is it May 6th is the first Tuesday in May? Whatever that first Tuesday in May is. Yeah. Okay, yeah. I was just starting to do research for our summer new books draft that we'll do on the Patreon in a couple of weeks earlier this week. And that, like, that first Tuesday of May is going to be a big day.
It's big day. Tough. And then there's some other stuff there, but it's a top heavier, and then June and the fall is a mess. Mm-hmm. September is going to be, we're going to expand it to 78 titles for the knockout round. I'm not sure what we're going to
do. I'm not ready for what September and October are going to be like for drafting.
Are you ready for Colson Whitehead to knock out Zadie Smith? Are you ready to do this?
Colson Whitehead's in the summer.
Oh, that's right. He's in July. It's going to be, it's Lauren Groff against Zadie Smith. Somehow that's worse and better. I don't know what we're going to do about this. What have we done?
Well, we can each pick one. We won't have to take them both off the board. We'll see.
For the knockout round for September, we've got a different thing. Yeah. We can't pick them both. This is what I've done to us.
That's true.
It was super fun. Well, I got a lot of good feedback on the episode, and everyone loved that. Everyone's loved that segment. Everyone's written back, so they love that. They like the interviews, too, but not surprising, people coming from this show like to hear us talk about it, but they really like the format. We're going to do it next month. I think we're going on an ongoing basis. First edition, wherever you get your podcast, there's links in the show notes to the Substack, Twitter, all that kind of stuff. But
I look forward to that becoming my favorite half hour on the phone on podcasting every month, doing that round. That's a really good time. Yeah.
Okay. And then the deep dive, which is Book Riot subscription newsletter through Substack. Check that in the show notes as well. Check out all the stuff going on there. I don't want to spend too much time on this because I don't want to spend any time on this, but I already spent time we didn't want to spend on the rumor that there was a Harry Potter reboot coming, and lo and behold, that was correct. And we don't hear, preface, caveat. We here at Book Riot are not interested in shouting out J.K. Rowling joints because of her transphobic stuff. At some point, you've got to talk about the news, and we're not going to talk. We're talking about this in the context of J.K. Rowling's transphobic. To me, that's the highlight. Is this? I don't know how to say this, Rebecca. The most throw in the superlative you want. It's Rowling for the last 30 years in books.
Yeah.
Maybe not the most artistic. And I think also the signal envelope pushing cultural movement of the last decade and probably the next decade will be about trans rights.
Yes.
And they've collided. Let me put it this different way. J.K. Rowling has decided to use her considerable influence and platform to do and say really hurtful and painful and damaging things about trans people. And at the worst possible moment for this discourse, she's coming in, and HBO has decided to come in and fund a 10-year-long, this is official news, there's a link in their show notes, reboot of the original Harry Potter series. So we're going to start at whatever Privet Drive, and we're going to go all the way through All Was Well over the course of 10 years. If Rowling was even just a neutral observer, I would be really into how are they going to break this up and talk. I don't want to do that because that's giving too much shine to this. The story here for me is A, that it's happening at all. And then B is, you know how I said it was going to go great? The discourse, this was going to go great for HBO. It's already going sideways, as we suspected.
This is otherwise the kind of thing we would be, even if we weren't super excited about the content ourselves, we'd be interested watchers of it, interested observers. We would probably want to do some Adaptation Nation kinds of stuff. Mm-hmm. We'd be making predictions about
content
casting.
For days, be, podcasts, newsletters, right. whatever, for weeks, decades worth of content here.
Right. A literal decade worth of content. We would be yes. wondering how they were going to maybe update or change the stories, any ways that they were going
Posting
to be, you know,
the trailers,
intentionally
casting
right
news,
intentionally more diverse in the way that most media has become intentionally more diverse. And we won't be doing any of that for mm-hmm. all of the reasons that you have just listed. And this is just going to be a thing. Variety had a piece yesterday covering the press conference right after this announcement. And this is like not for nothing. This is not just an announcement that HBO is making. This is the project that HBO has announced at the same time that they are saying, we're not just doing HBO Max anymore. Now we are Warner Brothers Discovery, the big parent company,
it's
is folding everything together. It's called Max. It has a great tagline. I envy the copywriter who wrote the one to watch as the tagline for Max. That's really good. The one to watch. Yeah, for the streaming service.
Okay, good job.
Pretty good. Yeah, good job to that copywriter. But this literal, first of all, who announces a decade-long TV series? Like, that's a lot of confidence that you know what the next decade in streaming is going to be like, and that's a bold move. But Casey Bloys, the chairman and CEO of HBO and now of Max Content, has declined to comment on Rolling's views, and he was asked if Rolling's views might affect their ability to find talent for the series, which is a really interesting way to pose that question. Not just will you have a hard time getting viewers, how is this going to affect your relationship to the viewing public?
Because you're going to be casting 9-year-olds and they're going to be asking about turfs.
Right.
I mean, have fun with that.
Right. Yeah. And adults who are interested in having long-running careers outside of appearing in this new series and after their time on however long they're on this decade-long series goes. And will this be a scarlet letter on your career if you're associated with it? He declined to comment. You know, he said part of it is that their priority is that is what's on screen. The story of Harry Potter is affirmative and positive and about self-acceptance, and that's their priority. But then he also says, that's a very online conversation, very nuanced and complicated, and not something we're going to get into. And I think calling this a very online conversation is a real misunderstanding. It was maybe a very online conversation the first time J.K. Rowling said what she said, which I believe was in an interview, and the interview got sort of passed around Twitter, and then she tweeted some things, and then she gave another interview, and she doubled down, and like, this is the thing that she's been doing now for the last about half a decade, saying pretty terrible things about trans people, and doubling down on them, and having it be passed around. But this is like not just an online thing. The New York Times has covered this in multiple places. It has reached mainstream media. I was wondering aloud last week, like, how much does the mainstream media consumer care about this? And I conducted a very unscientific poll of people in my life who are not book people to be like, do you know that there's all this transphobic stuff, right, with J.K. Rowling? Do the people in your life or like in your Facebook feed who aren't professional book people, do they talk about it? And everybody said, yes, I've heard about this. One person said, I think you can assume anybody between the ages of 20 and 40 who reads books has heard about it. I was like, that's interesting. And this was a person who just is a normal person in their life who reads a couple books every year. Casey Bloys has got the data for what people watch on HBO, and the Harry Potter franchise has spent a not small amount of time on HBO Max. It's moved
around.
The rights
seem to move
around.
Services, it's weird. I don't quite understand that.
Which is weird. It's currently back on HBO Max. And I would guess that what's going on here is he has seen the discourse, and he's also seeing what I would assume are still a lot of people watching Harry Potter. And I understand how you get to people are watching this original series. There's a lot of affection for it. We can make a remake and capitalize on this affection for this product, this franchise, and keep going. We can make it go for another decade. We're going to take it to the moon. I think that's a big assumption. It is a big assumption that, you know, while I think there are folks who are aware of all the problematic, awful stuff that Rowling has done, but who will still, you know, let themselves sit down and watch an old Harry Potter movie because they have attachment to it and because the kinds of things that she has said are not present in the content of the story. They're going to put their kids in front of it because those movies are, you know, sweet and affirming, whatever. But can you get a casually interested person who's aware of it to care about a new franchise that they don't have attachment to from when they were a kid or a young adult? And to be part of this discourse, it's really interesting. Like, Bob and I were talking about how this might connect to some of, you know, the criticism of Michael Jordan back from the 80s when he's first selling. We just saw Air this weekend, so it's Michael Jordan on the brain. But where he kind of declines to comment on politics because he says Republicans buy shoes too.
Right.
And I wonder if that's some of what's going on here with Casey Bloys. Conservative people watch HBO too. We don't want to alienate anybody by making a statement. But so much stuff that's on HBO tilts progressive. I've not seen their subscriber stats, but if I were a betting woman, I would bet that the HBO subscribership leans progressive as well. And I just have a lot of questions about the assumptions that are being made here and the harm that's caused by continuing to promote someone who has said and done such harmful things.
I don't have a lot to add. I mean, we could do a series of segments on a whole bunch of things related to this. I guess what I'll say is, from a business point of view, I think it's an unassailable decision in terms of a property. I've said for a long time, it's still the juggernaut for cultural whatever that you get rolling attached with it. I think probably changes that to some degree. I don't know how much, right? It's a meteor of zeitgeist. Does Rowling impacting herself on the side of it change the trajectory enough that it misses Earth or hits Earth or whatever the bad outcome for HBO is? I don't know the answer to that. I do know the video game Hogwarts Legacy came out and it was a smash hit and had all the similar kinds of things attached to it. Now, a reboot HBO 10 seasons of the original stuff. Oops, sorry, I edited myself there. is different than a video game. Also, Rowling, this Legacy was not really overseen by Rowling. They bought the rights from her somehow. I'm sure they can't do whatever, but Rowling is an executive producer here. This is not Rowling in the background, sort of this happens to be her property. She's making decisions. You have an exec producer thing here. This question's not going away. It's going to be continued to be asked. I think there is a Woody Allen situation possibly here in terms of you're not going to get the A-list talent. You're not going to get people.
Yeah.
And what that does to it, I don't want to equate them in terms of why people didn't want to work with them. I'm just saying that they're a similar dynamic of you doing this means you're going to ask questions for the rest of your life. It's different than Daniel Radcliffe and Emma Watson or Alan Rickman. Well, Alan Rickman's dead. But people who signed on for the original, this stuff wasn't hanging around their neck when they signed on or were doing press conferences and going to fan cons around this. It's different now. I wonder if this was their first choice. Because if it were me, my first choice, if I could do anything with Harry Potter, I'd get the original cast back together for the further adventures of Harry Potter. My guess is Emma Watson and Rupert Grint and Daniel Radcliffe don't want to touch up the 10-foot pole for a lot of reasons, but the pole got longer because of Rowling's positions about trans rights.
Well, yeah, I mean, Daniel Radcliffe is actively involved in, you know, LGBTQ activism and working with the Trevor Project. I've seen Emma Watson and Rupert Grint make similar statements. I think that's a really interesting wonder about what did HBO set out for? What were they hoping for? And how did they land on this idea? Man, I cannot get over decade long. What a big bet to place. And this, with this timing, I think we can't help but also think about sort of the inverted version of this that's happening with Bud Light right now, where they featured a trans influencer, a trans woman model in new advertisements. And they've lost billions of dollars in the last like 2 weeks because the customer, like a right-leaning customer base of Bud Light will not tolerate this. There's a risk here that far-right folks rally around J.K. Rowling and the stuff that she has said and make this a property that they latch onto, which is not an affiliation I think HBO would want to have. That's not the kind of crowd HBO's going for. They lean and market themselves towards, you know, highbrow, intelligent consumers and media viewers. And I just also would like to see the left have that same kind of really vociferous, coordinated response. It's reprehensible that people won't buy beer because a trans person is in an ad. Like, let me be unequivocal and very clear. I would like to see the left have an equally strong response, though, to how this is being done, to how an artist who has produced beloved work, but said really, really awful things. And as you said at the top of the segment, this is what she's decided to do with her power and her platform. And she doesn't have any intention, it seems, to have an open mind or to try to learn about it or to come around. There's like doubling down on top of doubling down.
Yeah.
How are we going to respond, really? And there just has to be a point where we say, okay, yeah, I loved those stories, but it's not worth it to me anymore. And I think that what you said last week about this maybe igniting a corner of the cultural war might be right. It'll be interesting to see also how this progresses between now and the time that that series launches. But I don't know.
That was my question today after everything that people are seeing online and all the coverage. Is like, no, what does Casey Bloys think today? Is he like, yep, that went about how I thought? I'm serious. Because like, maybe maybe you've done a little discounted free cash flow of goodwill already, and it still pencils out. I can, or yeah, are you, so. If you say that's an extremely online conversation and you underestimate it so badly, are you today like, what are we doing? I don't know.
Right. Like it's not just what the like 13% of the country that's on Twitter that's aware of this anymore and that cares about it. It's not chronically online folks exclusively. Lots of mainstream media coverage has reached this place of being aware and covering J.K. Rowling. And Bloys, I'm sure, is fully aware of what that conversation is. Attributing it to being extremely online, I think, is an attempt to dismiss it.
But it's going to be a real case study in the power of IP in a way that I don't think we've seen before. To have something we haven't, with Marvel or Star Wars or I'm just trying to, you know, DC, The Hobbit, and Game of Thrones, all of these juggernauts that have come through, they haven't come along with problematic fave stuff. I mean, there's a little bit of the Game of Thrones, and that's about depiction, and that's part of the text, and on the whole, but it's not about the creator being for people who tend to care more about culture with a capital C. We haven't seen one like this. We haven't seen.
It's almost,
can it break through? Can the snowball pick up the kind of protest and resistance and discourse with a lowercase d, not capital D? Can it just steamroll it? Or for something to be a juggernaut, it has to have no friction. And will enough friction be put up that's not going to work? It's going to be interesting.
Yeah, I think it's so complicated by the fact that it's about the creator and not about the content of the thing. Right. Because with Game of Thrones, especially, you know, like people talked about, I haven't seen it. It's really rapey, but it's not like George R.R. Martin is out here being a rape apologist. You know, like there's a clear division between him and the world he's created and the actions that his characters take. And there seems to be a relatively clear division between J.K. Rowling and the world that she's created and the things her characters say, but it's not a good one. Like she could do well to give herself a little dose of the Hogwarts magic and tolerance. And, you know, attempting to learn some stuff. But that's like, when it is about the content, I think it's a more straightforward decision for people of, am I going to watch this or not? Do I want to watch rapey content? Yes or no? Do I want to watch Harry Potter when I like the content, but I don't like the creator? I think is a more difficult decision for a lot of folks because you have to deny yourself something you would enjoy. Whereas when it's in the content, you're opting out of something you already know that you're not interested in or that you don't want to subject yourself to viewing.
And people have done some acrobatics around, well, I have, you know, I already have my Harry Potter on the shelf. So if I read it and like it, I'm not really contributing to the Rowling verse, right? I'm not going to be true with this. You're going to have a subscription or you ain't.
Right.
And you, what if you have a subscription to HBO Max and don't watch it? Well, you still have a subscription to HBO Max, or Max, I guess, in this case. It's going to be... it's. I feel terribly for the trans people out there that have this person in this world, which is so beloved. And I'd say, I'd say in my household, this is... We like these movies. We like these books. We've listened to them together, and the relationship is weird and compromised, and I'm not excited about this. In a different world, I would be really excited. My family would be really excited to see this.
Yeah.
And we've talked to them and told them why. We haven't talked about this news specifically, but we've talked about Rowling and what that means, and their schools are really good about gender issues, and you know, Rowan's part of a queer student alliance, even though she's, at this point, she's an ally in that situation. It's front and center, and I think you're right. I think you know, this is something that I've been constantly surprised by in terms of the pedagogy. And again, some of it's where I live, then where I grew up, but like, none of this was a conversation when I was 10.
No.
And it is a conversation now. And this move is hoping it, I mean, there's no other way to put this. This move HBO is making is hoping that doesn't matter. Hoping that dynamic shift doesn't matter. Is there another way to say this? And I don't know. I think that's the only way to say it. They hope it doesn't matter. And
As we're talking, I keep coming back to the way that the reporter posed the question to Casey Bloys of, will this make it more difficult for you to get talent? And if he thinks, if he really does think that this is an extremely online conversation, he has neglected to consider that actors today who aren't already famous do have to exist online, and they will receive all kinds of feedback, and they will be bullied. And if you have any kind of platform and following, if you've been in like anything that you have fans and a chunk of them lean, you know, liberal, and you're going to be in this show, you're going to hear about it. They've got to make that decision for, do I want this for my career? Do I want this for my mental health? Do I want to be on Instagram getting the kinds of messages that I'm going to get about why I chose to take money to do this thing? And that, will it be worth it? Like, can they actually get 10 years worth of people to act in this as it continues to happen? Because this is not an exclusively very online thing, but it does happen online because the internet is part of our world and part of our life today. Mm-hmm. And everyone affiliated with it, people who sign on to write for this show, are going to have to like decide, do they want to be on Twitter, or will this impact their Substack subscription? Are they going to get invited to be on the same kinds of TV industry podcasts that other people are, or will they be, you know, blackballed or pushed to the side because of affiliation with this? It's a real moment for, like, how do you want your career to go? This is probably going to be a pretty sweet paycheck, but will it be worth it in the long run?
Well, and it's one thing, like, think of where the conversation is now. I can only imagine in 4 to 5 years, when this is in the middle of things, that we're going to be further down the line. Mm-hmm. This is only going to get, I think the course of history is not even, things go badly. I do think over time, I mean, I've just seen in my own life with gay rights, just to use one example, that's probably the closest corollary. It's a different world than I could have imagined at 13.
Absolutely.
I hope through the work of time and then activism and a lot of pain and people putting their bodies on their line, just like with gay rights. I'm not saying it's easy or inevitable. But in 5 years, I think the conversation will proceed even further. And then in 10 years, and then I think you could be looking real bad as Bloys, HBO, whole thing in 10 years.
Yeah, what is Casey Bloys thinking about his legacy today, and how will he feel about it in 5 years is a really great question.
Or do they even think, I mean, that's assuming that they've done the risk assessment that you and I are doing. Maybe we have different macroeconomic models about culture, about how this is working. Because if I think what we're both saying is, if they're working off our same sort of climate model for this, they're moving to Duluth, Minnesota on this. They're not getting anywhere close to this situation.
Yeah.
They may think that it doesn't matter in the way that we think. And if it does, it's still worth doing. And boy, that's a hard place. That's a hard place to, I don't know, to feel any sympathy or generous reading of for me personally.
Yeah.
All right.
Hopefully we won't have to say much about this again for a long time.
Yeah, I don't know what... We don't want to cover this except to cover the coverage and like the macro cultural ideas, because I think it matters in the world of books reading. I think a lot of people who read books and care about books are wrestling with issues like this around this particular series, and then how this plays out in a bunch of different ways. But unless there, you know, unless there's direct discourse around how HBO makes a statement around trans rights, or Rowling does, or someone who gets cast is, we're not going to be covering this as a product on its own terms. Going forward. So got to go somewhere else for that. Let's take our second sponsor break. I needed to transition out of that. So we did our second sponsor a little bit earlier today, but you know, we got 9 seconds. People hear some ads in there. We got 9 seconds.
Shake it off.
Better?
Yeah.
First quarter bestsellers. I've got zero interesting things to say.
Same. It's the same list of uninteresting things we say about most big lists of bestsellers. It's 24 white people, or 24 books by white people. Colleen Hoover is half of the top 10, but Prince Harry holding it down with number one. Spare sold just over 1.1 million units.
Oh, I'm sorry. I cut out there for a second. I have to edit that out. I don't know. Spare. I guess Spare is the story of the year. Now it seems like a million years ago.
Yeah, it does. It seems like a million years ago. It's, you know, it sold 1.1 million units, which is about what Colleen Hoover's books in number two and number three sold combined. It Starts With Us and It Ends With Us each sold about 550,000. If I'm softening the numbers a little bit. Spare, one of those cultural events that's not a book event. I think like a lot of people picked up Spare, but the book world didn't talk about it really that much before it came out, talked about it a little bit as it came out, and is not continuing to talk about it in any other year. A book that sold a million units in 3 months. We're talking about the content of it and like the cultural significance, but a giant celebrity memoir that not for nothing, like he gave so many interviews that you don't have to buy the book to know what's going on in there. It feels like a non-story. There's nothing surprising about the fact that a former royal, like a royal who's now, I guess, basically a former royal who has been all over the news and has made a very public life for himself in talking about why he's leaving the royalty and that way of living. Like, okay, of course that's going to sell a lot of books.
If you had to pick, I don't know. Is there, what's the most interesting thing on this list? Is it Spare?
Maybe. I continue to be surprised that Lessons in Chemistry
was
so big last year and is continuing to hold it down. It is set, we both really liked the book, but it's a weirdo of a book and has some surprising elements, deals with some difficult stuff that you don't necessarily know it's going to deal with. And I think it does just have something kind of magical about it that folks are enjoying because it's continuing to sell very well. And there's a TV series coming out later this year.
Yep.
But I think that is the most interesting thing about this list is that Bonnie Garmus was such a surprise bestseller and is holding it down consistently. It wasn't a flash in the pan.
Yeah, number one best-selling hardcover fiction book last week, according to BookSan, moving 12,000 copies. So it's right there. Yeah. I'm looking on Amazon right now, 134,000 ratings. So you shouldn't be waiting to get this in paperback, is what I'm saying. We're going to have a Crawdads two-and-a-half-year run of Lessons in Chemistry. I hope it gets the Crawdads run with a good series coming out from Apple. The book is way more interesting than Crawdads.
So
it's not even close. You know, if I had every book in the world to pick from to get Crawdads run, I wouldn't pick Lessons in Chemistry, but that's neither here nor there. I'm very much in favor of this being the kind of book that people are going to pick up because it's the kind of book people pick up and it has that recursive self-reinforcing cycle. Glad to see it.
I am too. I'm glad to see Daisy Jones and the Six is at number 11. I think that's on the heels of the Amazon series coming out. But, you know, Taylor Jenkins Reid hasn't needed much help selling any of her debut novels.
She's looking at last week's bestsellers compared to this list just to see, because I feel like, and I could be wrong, the Colleen Hoover tide going out a little bit, and that's gonna, you know, it's gonna take some time because there's so much power. But sound wild to say, but she's only got two of the top 20 best-selling books of the week last week, which in any normal person would be like, this is the biggest thing of the year. But when you're coming off. Was it last summer where she had eight?
It was like
eight of
the top 10 or something.
It was seven of the top 10. So that seems to be waning.
I do think
maybe
it's
like a wildflower. There's not enough dry tinder out there. Like you've burned through the forest. You know, I mean, all of us should decline in such a fashion, but it does seem to be petering out.
It feels like it's slowing down.
Yeah. Even though she was named one of Time's most influential people just today. I don't know if you saw that list. It came out today.
I did not see that list. I'm sure she loves the attention. Poor Colleen Hoover.
Yeah, there are a couple other, who are the other writers? Neil Gaiman. They broke it up in a weird way because I thought it would only be, there's like artist icons, pioneers, but it has nothing to do with anything. Like you could be a writer and be in the artists or the pioneers or the icons. less clear to me. There's a librarian that was named by someone, which is Minjin Lee wrote a, this woman's name. I don't know.
Love
I don't
that.
Have it from me. We'll talk about it next week. But I saw Colleen Hoover. Her little blurb was written by Jenna Bush Hager, which I thought was very, very interesting to see.
Jenna Bush Hager is like, actually, I'm just going to go ahead and put my money down. I bet in the next couple of years we get a Jenna Bush Hager imprint. I think that's coming.
Yeah,
she's really kind of insinuating herself into the book scene.
If you're doing what she does, is that a lateral move, though? I mean, why do you care? You're making TV money. TV money is so different than book money. It's not even
why
close.
Does Sarah Jessica Parker care?
Because she already made all the TV money.
Well, yeah. So, I mean, Jenna Bush Hager's not hurting for
well, no, but I mean, like, Sarah, I mean, it's a fair point, and I'm only wrestling with it because I think you're right. So having said that, I think the point is well taken, except that Hager has the platform right now where Sarah just, she puts a book on TV once a month and talks about the author, and Parker was off Sex of the City. And even if she was still on Sex of the City, there's not like a SJP recommends 9-minute interlude in the middle of the episode. Like, it's a different situation.
I just think all roads lead back to vocational awe with this publishing stuff, you know, that you can be as famous and as rich as Jenna Bush Hager is, and you get to talk about books and recommend them on air and have a book club that helps people pick out books and that maybe influences sales, even though no one has ever done good data around it. But the idea, if you grew up being the kind of person who wants to do that, the idea of like, I could be not just someone who consumes books and recommends them, but helps create them, super magical. I think it just has a lot of pull, and presumably the celebrities who take these imprint offers aren't doing it because there are boatloads of money attached.
Yeah,
there's something about getting to be part of making books, and you're a person who loves books, and they don't really have to give up anything to be able to do it because they're not like 22-year-old college graduates who are going to take a low-paying job just to work in the industry that they love. They've already positioned themselves to do a whole bunch of other successful things, and now you also get to say you're helping, you know, publish books. And if you're a person,
do you think
your
show
books,
would
I
let her
it.
Like shout her own book as part of the book club that she? That seems like a weird.
Oh.
We've talked about this before. With
I don't
like
know
the
if
Oprah
they'd let
situation,
her pick her
right?
own
like,
book as a
so
yeah.
Strange.
Yeah, I don't know if they would let her pick her own book, but I'm sure they'd let her talk about it on the show.
Yeah. Jenna picks Jenna books. There's an Ouroboros nature to that. And we've talked about this before, of like the celebrity influencer. It's one thing if you're pointing to that one over there. It's another one where you're picking your own book week after week, month after. I just don't know if that works.
And here's my thing. Right.
Yeah, right. I'm just not really sure. Speaking about here's my thing. This is my favorite
good segue.
Nothing burger. I'm glad this exists. I should say this right away. I'm glad this exists. I don't love the social media headlines that I saw, which was, you'll never believe what I found out. And when I went to go investigate Barack Obama's reading list, this is by Sophie Vershbo in Esquire. And the thing I'll never believe is, I don't know what the thing I wasn't supposed to leave was, because the nut of this here is, and I think this is worth reading because she talks to a bunch of people in the book industry. The thing we won't believe is he seems to actually like books. Is that what I wasn't supposed to believe in my clickbaity headline, Rebecca? Is that your sense of what that would have been?
I think so. It's such a bait and switch headline. And I've been,
which Sophie
the longer
doesn't write,
that I've
by
had
the way.
This piece.
She didn't write that. They don't
right,
write that. That's not the author's
fault. Yeah, not Sophie's fault. Don't come for Sophie.
No.
But in the couple of days since this piece landed, I've gotten like increasingly salty about it because it's like several thousand words that are basically no new information about how this book list gets made. She asks people in publishing if they try to pitch Obama's list. Everyone evades the question of like, well, of course we would hope, but no one says yes or no. Like, yes, we try to get books to him, or no, we've never tried it. There's one like pretty direct answer where somebody at Penguin Random House, which of course publishes the Obamas, says what he does is up to him. We don't try to get our books in his hands. Like, and I think that's a good, you want to have that division and let him, you know, make his list. You don't want to try to like use the president as your influencer if you're Penguin Random House. Not a great move. So I'm glad that they didn't do that. But there's like I think Sophie asks all the right questions here of all the right people, and the people don't really give helpful answers. The closest we get to an answer is Eric Schultz, who was a senior advisor.
That was the one for me. That was the most interesting one for me as well.
Yeah, he said that emails from book publicists have no bearing on what Obama chooses to read and release as part of his reading list. Obama's taste is, quote, a reflection of the inputs he has. Okay, what are those inputs then?
That's the thing.
That is the piece I want to read.
And we're not going to get it unless you get Obama on the record. And that's the thing she couldn't get. And
right.
You can't, this is goes back to the old logic of you can't prove a negative. You can't prove the absence of influence or whatever. I mean, he's got to be influenced by something. He's not going into a bookstore with no knowledge of anything and picking out books. None of us do this. Okay, and that's right. Fair. That's
and Schultz
fine.
Is acknowledging it here. Yeah. He's a reflection of the inputs he has, but so he has. I would like
what
to know.
What are the inputs? Yeah, what are the inputs?
Right. Is it, you know, like I got up this morning, I saw a book review in the New York Times. My friend told me about a book they read. Something came across my Instagram and I heard an interview on a podcast. And those are some inputs I had. Okay, what are the inputs? And like clearly Obama is a consumer of media. He reads a lot of books. He makes lists of them. He listens to a lot of music. He makes curated Spotify lists. I think he even does movie lists. Like he is like any of us. He's, as you were saying, getting those like ideas for what to pick up somewhere. Even if no one is curating for him, he's got sources. And that is the question. I understand how this piece gets written because this writer gets assigned to go do this thing. And so she investigates and then she's going to write a couple thousand words about her investigation. But it feels pretty similar to me to the Wired interview with Brandon Sanderson a couple of weeks ago that was like, I had to go write a piece about Brandon Sanderson and here's my 4,000 words about how I have nothing to say. Like, this is much less egregious than that was, but there is nothing to say here except Obama has inputs. It's real. You have to take our word for it, which it was already what we were having to do.
Yeah, I guess. No, I don't think anyone had said any. I appreciate the piece because it asked the same kind of question I would ask. That, I mean, it's like printing null results of an experiment in scientific journals. We get success bias because only successful with notable experiments.
That's true.
I don't mind this at all because she did the work. These are real quotes. This is now part of the record. Some point, Obama's going to say something about this. And it's either going to confirm this or it's going to deny this. In both cases, this is an interesting historical document to me. Some of the people went on the record. The piece I take issue with is not anything Sophie did. I think she did everything she could to get a quote. She got pretty close to someone who, you know, deputy press secretary,
that's involved
in public communications. He is unequivocal here. This is not a staff-led exercise. These lists come from him. But I disagree, he says, comma, and I think if it was, it wouldn't pass the smell test. These lists wouldn't be as salient or get as much traction if it wasn't coming from him directly. I think that's false. I think you could fake the list he puts up. Because you know why? We've looked at the list, we're like, is this my list? If you had people around him that cared about books at any particular way and were paying attention to book media at all, you could make a list that passed the smell test. You absolutely could. You could totally fake this. And that's why we're confused.
100%.
And that's the only reason we have this question, because there's not a paragraph from him that explains anything about it. It's like a sentence that is it's about it, but it's pretty generic. It's not like, I'm not sure that ChatGPT could do it, but ChatGPT with a little spin maybe could. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's not inconceivable that this is ginned up in a way that we wouldn't like.
Right.
Whatever that would look like. I don't think it is. And I don't know what the purpose of that would be right now.
Yeah, I don't think it is either, especially because he really started doing them after he left office and has really not much, if anything, to gain from having done it. And Sophie does interview like some other bloggers and influencers and book talk folks who are skeptical, too suspicious to outright disbelieve that Obama actually reads these books and makes these lists. I don't understand what there would be for them to gain from doing it. I do think you could if you wanted to fake this list, you could, I agree, fake it pretty easily because we have a very good sense of the kind of thinker.
We should do that, Rebecca, for a segment.
Oh,
when does he release
these
things?
Usually in December, or like maybe June and December. Yeah, we should do a guessing about what will be on the Obama list. Because we know like the kind of thinker he is, generally what he's interested in, and a pretty eclectic approach, but also relatively safe. He's not usually picking anything that's like super edgy. So I think we could that would be a fun exercise to do. Mm-hmm. I think I've always believed that they were books he read and reflections of his taste. Because
I would bet on that.
I have a lot of faith from having watched him lead for 8 years and listening to him speak for 8 years that this is a person who is reading a lot of books and thinking about the world in a deep way. So I haven't been confused about what is the source of these, or did his advisors help him pick which books to put on this list. I've been totally willing to believe that those were genuine. I just want to know what the inputs are, yeah, man.
What's the discovery question? What's the search and destroy mechanism here?
And to be fair, it's also probably as boring as everyone else's answers are. Like, you know, it just, I talk to my friends, I see things on the internet, yeah. I read reviews. It's just that, like, his friends are famous, many of them, or more interesting, or have access to other kinds of information.
A little disingenuous about he's not influenced, but like if Oprah is like, dude, you've got to read this and the Napolitano book, is that your friend or is that a publicist? That's like not normal. He's not getting them from normal ways, except he is, if that makes sense. Like that might be a normal thing for him, that like those are the people in his life that influence him. But like you influence me and I influence you, but that's not how other people are. They're not influenced by professional book people, but just so happens that we also give each other's recommendations.
Right. And it's interesting to think about like the people in your life and my life that are kind of secondarily influenced by each of us. Like I read a thing that you've recommended to me or that a publicist that I trust has sent me.
We trust publicists we trust. We listen to publicists. I think that would be okay to admit here. I don't think anybody would be like, God, this is a bunch of fakeness. Yeah. Anyway, sorry.
Yeah. No, I think it is okay to admit you have some you trust, you have some that are fine, and then you have some that you probably don't trust very much. But that if I take a recommendation from one of those sources that's inside the industry and I give it to one of my like book reading normie friends outside the industry, they've then been influenced in a way that their other, like the other members of their book club haven't. Because those folks are just going to Barnes and Noble and looking what's on the table. But that member of the book club has access to somebody who has access to the industry. And Obama's in a similar but much fancier kind of ecosystem. I would love to hear him talk about it. He's been doing some podcast interviews recently.
He has a literary agent and an eight-figure deal at Crown. There are people he knows in publishing. Let's get that off the table.
Yeah,
that
is, you know what
that
I
he
really
is completely
want.
Chinese wall off from publishing is a canard. Do not believe that.
Yeah,
I don't believe.
I don't believe that either. And you know, I would love the last three questions on every episode of the Ezra Klein Show are: what are three books you would recommend for our audience? And the person has to talk about them. It's like these three things, and here's why. I just want an hour of that. What are you recommending? Where did you learn about it? Why are you recommending it? What is interesting to you about these titles? Because when we look at his list, I can guess, we can guess, we've done it on this show for years about like, oh yeah, it makes sense to me. He read that and seems to be in the wheelhouse of the stuff he's interested in. You can imagine what the paragraph he would write would be about those books. But yeah, I don't want to knock Sophie. This is a hard thing, a hard question to try to get answers to. I think I'm frustrated on her behalf that the real question is, what are those inputs and how difficult it seems to be to get someone to talk about that? Which also, like, why does it need to be that difficult? There's probably not anything really secretive or surprising.
Well, that's, I guess there's that piece of doubt, too. It's like, why? I'm assuming that a reporter for Esquire can at least get a no comment from someone close to the current Obamas, right? Like, why plead the fifth on this?
But also, there are like 12 people in the world, and we're two of them who care this much about what Obama's reading list
is. This did a lot of, I saw this all over book Twitter. Like, this got passed around. So, I mean, this is the kind of thing I like to be on there for. A, I saw this first on there, but I could see, like, did this get any pickup? But you saw there was some pickup because people are interested. And I think it speaks to his mythos, his sensibility, the continued interest in him as a person and thinker, that there's a hunger just to like know more about his reading life. And these picks are interesting. Mm-hmm. You know, if I could only pick 12 books a year to read and I had to like pre-select who would pick them for me and sort of like as a public figure, I'm picking Obama's list from the ones I see. I think you could do a lot worse. So some of it is just sort of a feeling of kinship, right? Of like, Are you reading the tweets? Like, what are you doing? I also could believe these are the kind of books that if all he did was read the New York Times book review every Sunday, he could get the same list. That would be very plausible to me.
He could
He's
get
a
very
bit
close.
Older than us. I think that could be a very, he's like, I read the New York Times Book Review. You know, I read the news. I read the Washington Post. These are all the kind of books that tend to get picked there. That would explain the norminess
NPR,
of it.
NPR. Dude's listening to a lot of NPR.
Yeah, he's listening to Terry Gross. Totally believe that. Does that make him basic reader? Sure. Is that a good thing for people to know? Absolutely. So, you know,
yes.
Whatever. He can do whatever he wants. He's not doing anyone any disservice here. But it feels, I do think there's something weird about, at this point, he cares enough about books to make these lists and post them on Instagram, but then not to go to the next step to be like, answer a reporter's question about, just even a comment, like, yeah, I like to read. Mm-hmm. That's enough. Maybe that feels like you're deigning to even entertain that it's something other than that. I mean, I wonder what the approach to this is like.
Yeah, right? I would love an approach that's like, what are the last five books that you loved? Where did you learn about them? Mm-hmm. You know, that would be something like that would be interesting.
So
anyway,
because here's the framing I don't like. I set out to expose a secret apparatus of industry shenanigans. What I found was more shocking. Could we just do... I was really interested in how this list was made, and I was trying to figure it out. And this is what I figured
out. Also, the existence of a secret apparatus of industry shenanigans would imply that these lists are doing something noticeable enough.
Or he's getting kickbacks from the publishers
sales.
To name them or something.
Right, right. Either this list is influential and is affecting sales, which is not something that we've seen any evidence or conversation about.
Yeah.
Or people think that he's like taking kickbacks, which is also not something we've seen any evidence or conversation about. Like, why would there need to be a secret scaffolding of stuff around making this list appear? Because if you're going to go to all of the work to do that, it would be for some kind of gain. And best I've seen in the 7 years he's been making these lists, he's not gaining anything from it. And I don't think that publishers are gaining anything from it. It's not like any of the books on his list have spiked in sales the week after
at
he releases
at the margins,
the list.
I would think. It makes them feel good. Maybe they move a few units. Yeah, doesn't seem like
right. Like, mate, and you know, if you get to go tell an author that you publish that they made it onto President Obama's best books of the year list, maybe that's a great day if you're a book publicist. Mm-hmm. You know, that would be a nice thing to be able to point to. But there's like, this list has, for as much as I love these lists that I'm interested in what President Obama reads and has to say about it, there is no like concrete utility to it to the book industry. It's not helping move units. So why would there be secret shenanigans?
Yeah. And here, I'll go a bit further. Even if he was getting a bunch of pitches for books from publicists and he was like looking through his arcs, which A, is not happening. Great.
Hilarious. Yeah.
Get books to her. I mean, that's fun. I don't see the problem with that.
What I want to know is, do President Obama's requests on NetGalley ever get turned down?
Look, I'm waiting on Yellowface. I don't know what I have to do with William Morrow. I can't bring myself to humble myself and use your login, which I know I can do, but I cannot bring myself to do it.
Or to send a well-placed, don't you know who I am email.
I don't have it in me, Rebecca. I don't have it in me. You know this.
I really know you don't. I do.
I can't do it. I will and grinch about it publicly, but...
You're in good company because Barack Obama's not doing that either.
Do you think he could get a Yellowface copy? Yellowface.
I'm pretty sure that if he...
That might be number one with a bullet on my Guess Obama's list. Right now, I've got The Late Americans and Yellowface. Not to step on our main knockout conversations, but...
Yeah. I think that if he has a friend or an associate email somebody in publishing, or if he touches base with his editor at PRH and says, hey, saw your publishing, this title I'm interested in, can I see an early copy? He's getting it.
His assistant is getting that copy for him. So I'm going, if I'm off the dome, Poverty by Matthew Desmond, The Late Americans, Yellowface, The Whitehead.
Definitely The Whitehead and the News 80 Smith.
News 80 Smith. I don't keep up with the political history books outside of the Poverty by Matthew Desmond.
And the last couple Lauren Groff books have made his list. We've got a Lauren Groff this year. That's gonna
the Nicole Chung, The Living Remedy is a lot about healthcare failure, and that's something he cared about. Actually, one question I had about that, Obamacare was available in Oregon for that. So I'm not exactly sure what happened, but that's one that crosses the literary stream with the policy stream, I could easily see that being on his list at the end of the year. We're only
I would believe that the Rick Rubin Creative Act might show
Oh my God, that's a great call.
I would not be shocked. Right?
Jack Black Jesus is definitely going to be on that list.
I think all I want in life now is for Barack Obama and Rick Rubin to talk to each other on a 900-hour long podcast.
Where do you think Rick Rubin gets his books? Does he summon them in an incantation?
There's definitely a cauldron involved.
Actually, no, because he decided not to have his kidney removed or something because he wandered into a bookstore and a science book happened to be open about why you should have your appendix out. He just wanders into bookstores barefoot and lets the universe call to him.
Yeah. You know, he lives in California. They've got a lot of good bookstore options.
It's easier to be barefoot in California, show title.
It is easier to be barefoot in California. Maybe the Eleanor Catton, Burnham Wood. I wouldn't be surprised to see that.
Yeah, it feels a little, maybe. I would go a little bit more the Rebecca Mackay. It's a little more, I don't know, mainstream, weirdly. Like, they're literally thrillers, right? I think Mackay's got the juice. That book seems to be selling pretty well.
And S.A. Cosby has made his list a couple times, so there's a new one of those this year.
One of those. Yeah.
We're stepping on our future episode, Jeff. We're just guessing
now. Well,
we've got
8 months. People forget. I'll forget. I'm getting old, Rebecca. Last story. We'll save some for at least four for next week. I thought speaking of long profiles, this was a really good one in Wired of Andy Hunter and Bookshop. There's a lot to be learned. This is a company we followed on this show, but also in the interesting news. I know Andy a little. I've talked to him sometimes, so disclaimer, I guess.
We've done some business with Bookshop.
But it's a good profile, and the news is that they took on, and I knew this was coming from conversation with Andy before, they're launching ebooks on Bookshop, and it's going to be clunky. And he even says that. One thing I like about Andy is he acknowledges the difficulty of some things and does them anyway because he thinks there's the right thing to do. Because it's sort of a quixotic thing, and I should even take out that equivocation, to say we're going to build a bookshop online that won't be that much cheaper and it's going to compete with Amazon, and we're going to confederate all these. It's in there. It's in the phrase. We're going to confederate these independent bookstores under one roof and try to. Right. And it's worked, Rebecca. There's no denying it's worked.
It has.
And there's a lot that's gone into it. I really recommend it. I don't know if it's going to work, but I've said that about a lot of things Bookshop does. So what do I know at this point? But that's one thing they've had trouble with as ebooks. And there's some audiobook stuff there I don't quite understand. Because when are Libro and Bookshop going to get together and tango is what I need to know. Does someone need to acquire someone? It feels like that pairing is natural. You need a one-stop. If this to really work and to be the Amazon competitor, you need ebooks and audiobooks too. On a platform. And Andy recognized that, especially from the ebook situation. The audiobook stuff, it's difficult. Raising new money, $2.3 million. Sounds like I will be checking this out. If this can work, I'll be looking at this as well, but I really recommend that. I'll have to get the front list for you next week. We got other stuff to record. Go check out First Edition. Listen to me, Rebecca, talk about other things. I've got a new podcast. I've got a new episode coming out on Tuesday, the 19th. The opening segment there is me and Vanessa Diaz and Kelly Jensen, other Book Riot editors, and we're going to talk about the legacy and the current reading and getting ready for the movie adaptation of Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret, by one Judy Blume.
I just finished
my rereading yesterday, and it was like a portal to being 12 years old and reading that book again.
Did you read it when you were a kid?
I did. I read it. I mean, I read almost everything in my elementary school library.
Okay.
And let me tell you, as a 12-year-old boy, I learned a lot of things. And I didn't even know what I learned.
I bet you did.
I learned a lot of things. I think I may have learned about Playboy through Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret. That's how big of a nerd
Amazing.
I am.
Amazing. The only 12-year-old boy who learned about Playboy from Judy Blume.
It's hard to remember these things now, but I remember reading about Playboy in Are There, God? And just, I don't need to do this much disclosure, but a bit of a late bloomer I was. And I'm not sure I would have known to even be interested in Playboy when I was 12.
Interesting.
When I read this book. So
I think
it's
when I was that age, reading Judy Blume, my assumption was that no boys were going to be reading that book or would be interested in it. That's cool. I can't wait to listen to
y'all
talk about
that. I
read
The Mohegans when I was in sixth grade because I was out of stuff to read in my school library. So that just, I had blown. And I've been like, I've been like this. When I saw the girls reading, I was like, what the hell is that book? I read all the Nancy Drew I could get my head on. I had strep throat one summer, and I was down for 10 days, and I had my dad bring me Nancy Drew in the library. It was great. Maybe
that'll
the best
do
week
it.
Of my
That's
life.
That's a good marathon. Yes. Oh, yeah. Oh, we should do something with Nancy Drew.
There's so much. What do you even pick? The first one? Anyway.
I don't know. I got a writer friend who's a big Nancy Drew head. We could do something.
Okay.
Figure it out.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. So I know Vanessa and Kelly have a relation to that book. I have no idea what they're going to say. I'm very excited.
I cannot wait. I'm so jealous. Can I just come to the Zoom and listen?
You know, you could subscribe wherever you get your podcast, Rebecca. It's there waiting for you. It'll show up as soon as
I
it's ready.
You.
Yeah. All right.
Not
Thanks,
special
everybody.
Access even for me.
You know you're going to listen to the show and give me notes on it. Rebecca listened to the last episode and she's like, actually, I've gotten the wrong order. I'm like, God damn it. She's right. So I had to go rewrite the show. It's really frustrating when you're right about stuff like that. It makes me crazy.
You're welcome.
All right. bookriot.com/listen. Shoot us an email, podcast@bookriot.com. Talk to y'all later.